This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, April 28, 2010. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, authorities struggle to contain the massive oil spill in the Gulf Coast as it nears the Louisiana shore. One aspect of the financial reform bill, protection for consumers, could be influenced by lobbyists. And we'll go to Los Angeles, where a mobile clinic is providing free health care to thousands of uninsured patients. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A giant 130-turbine wind farm, 5 miles off the coast of Cape Cod, finally got the green light from the Obama administration today, a year and a half after completion of a favorable environmental review. FSRN's Hamilton Kahn reports.
At a press conference in Boston, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar said the, quote, difficult decision to go ahead with the wind project was made after he received a letter from the governors of 6 eastern states who argued that delaying the project based on claims by Indian tribes and others would set a prohibitive precedent.
We believe that there is a huge potential for offshore wind along the Atlantic, and the same kinds of arguments that have been made against the Cape Wind application in the Nantucket Sound could be made with respect to many of the other projects that are being proposed up and down the Atlantic.
The announcement follows an epic 10-year battle between clean energy advocates and well-financed opponents on Cape Cod. The offshore wind farm would be the first of its kind in the U.S. Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick predicted that the $2 billion construction project could begin in about a year. Hamilton Kahn, FSRN, Massachusetts.
A coalition of stakeholders has announced plans to challenge the offshore wind farm decision. In a statement released this afternoon, Native American tribes, commercial fishermen, environmental groups, and several local towns say the decision tramples the rights of the people of Cape Cod. The U.S. Supreme Court today is hearing closing arguments in a case about the anonymity of people who sign petitions to refer a state ballot measure. The case comes out of Washington State, where signers of a public petition to overturn domestic partnerships said they were afraid they would be targeted by gay and other groups if their names were made public. State transparency laws require the release of the names, and the Ninth Circuit Court upheld the state law, but the Supreme Court blocked the release until it could hear the case. In other Supreme Court news, the court ruled today the Latin cross erected by the VFW decades ago in the Mojave National Preserve could remain pending further lower court review. Justice Anthony Kennedy said in the majority opinion that the Latin cross has significance beyond Christian interpretations and does not evoke state-sanctioned support of one religion. The long-standing cross was only questioned in Salazar versus Buono when the Park Service denied a request by Buddhists to build a shrine in the preserve. Nearly a month ago, FSRN reported more than 1,000 members of a nurses' union at Temple University Hospital walked off the job. But now, after 4 days of negotiating, the nurses will likely return to work later this week. From Philadelphia, Matthew Petrillo has this update.
About 1,500 members of the Pennsylvania Association of Staff Nurses and Allied Professionals went on strike in March after working 6 months without a contract. The nurses argued the hospital should provide full tuition reimbursement for nurses' children and pay increases. Hospital administrators contended its nurses are the region's best paid. To replace the striking workers, the hospital hired an additional 850 temporary nurses. They worked mostly 12-hour shifts, which included lots of costly overtime hours. The nurses' union argued that money could have been used for their pay increases. The union and the hospital reached a provisional agreement last night, and today the union will vote on that contract. The new contract increases wages and offers partial tuition reimbursement for dependents. Matthew Petrillo, FSRN, Philadelphia.
The Oklahoma legislature has overridden the governor's veto on 2 laws that place further restrictions on abortion providers in the state. The law drawing the most attention is a measure that requires women seeking abortions, even victims of rape and incest, to undergo invasive vaginal ultrasounds and listen to a detailed description of the fetus. Yesterday's vote was immediately followed by a lawsuit by the Center for Reproductive Rights, who says requiring the ultrasound is a constitutional violation of privacy. In the UK, nearly 5,000 female workers have won the right to be paid the same as their male colleagues. From Birmingham, FSRN's Naomi Fowler reports.
This is a case that has highlighted the inequalities in pay between men and women that still exist in the 21st century. Lawyers believe the payout could be as much as $300 million, and there could be a further 20,000 women who may be entitled to come forward and lodge a claim. All of the women in the suit were employed by the local government in traditionally female-dominated fields, such as cleaning and catering. The Employment Tribunal heard how some men doing the same pay-graded jobs as women earned four times more and arbitrary bonus payment schemes. The starkest example was one instance where a garbage collector had taken home $75,000 a year, while women on the same pay level received less than $18,000. The local authority says it faces financial ruin and will appeal. Naomi Fowler, FSRN, Birmingham.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. Today, the U.S. Coast Guard said it will set fire to part of the oil spill in the Gulf Coast. The control burn is aimed at stopping the spread of the crude oil, which has reached as close as 20 miles to the coast of Louisiana. The U.S. Coast Guard has said that the spill could become one of the most significant oil spills in U.S. history if it is not stopped soon. So far, attempts to shut off the flow of oil deep in the ocean have failed, and 42,000 gallons of crude oil are gushing into the waters each day. The spill spans a 600-mile circumference, and strong currents have pushed the oil closer to the coast of Louisiana and Alabama. The spill is the result of an explosion last week at an oil rig owned by British Petroleum. The explosion is presumed to have killed 11 workers, and the cause is still under investigation. Conditions are rapidly changing, and joining us now is Aaron Viles, campaign director from the Gulf Restoration Network in New Orleans. He's been monitoring the situation both on and off the coast. Welcome to FSRN.
Thanks for having me.
You visited the site of the spill just a few days ago. What did you see in terms of the magnitude of the oil spill?
Well, it's an enormous spill. At this point, it's bigger than Delaware. It's spread out in the Gulf of Mexico. It's a range. There's a sheen that stretches really for miles and miles and miles, and then there's a kind of a chocolate mousse that the crude has been churned into by wave action. It's kind of got a reddish, brownish hue, and that is a little more concentrated, but is also being taken by the currents and being taken by the wind and stretching for miles. So it is a mess, and it's something that has unfortunately really gotten out of hand.
The Coast Guard has said it is dropping chemical dispersants and using skimming on the ocean to try to contain the oil spill. Did you see evidence of that, and how does the cleanup look at this point?
We actually flew over it twice, and in both days, subsequent days that we looked at the site, we didn't see any booms being deployed. We didn't see any active skimming happening. All that they were able to do was to drop a chemical dispersant on the slick and on the sheen to try to volatilize it quicker. So it's a mess out there, and what we're seeing here is there's just not really an effective plan B to deal with these types of accidents, because the seas weren't terribly rough. We were talking about 3-foot swells maybe. So if they're not able to operate these skimmer boats in these types of situations, that's a pretty calm day for the Gulf of Mexico. So this is just a horrible situation. It's bad and getting worse.
And when you were there, did you see any signs of marine life?
As we were flying in, my pilot spotted something, and looking at the area and looking at what uses that area, our best guess is that it was a sperm whale. We've heard that as well from Fish and Wildlife. They saw 3 sperm whales in the area. This is a really important area for our resident pod of sperm whales. It's where they feed. It's called the Mississippi Canyon, and it's so deep that's where they dive down and actually eat the squid, catch the squid and sharks, other things that they eat. And it's a really important area for the ecology of the Gulf of Mexico, the marine environment here. We also know there are whale sharks in the area. We know this is an area that's, you know, transected by lots of different sea turtle species, many of which are threatened and endangered. And then also, this is the time of year, this is the, you know, the really most important time of the year for bluefin tuna spawning. And bluefin tuna are a really an amazing animal. They're kind of a globetrotter species, but their only known spawning ground for the western Atlantic bluefin tuna population is here in the Gulf of Mexico. So this is their most active spawning time, and where they've had the spill, they've certainly, and the scientists have found larvae in the past, and so we know this is an important area for them as well.
Well, the focus right now is on containing this very serious situation, but what does this tell us about oil production or safety, environmental risks in the Gulf Coast area, that what needs to be done in order to prevent this sort of thing from happening?
If you are opening your coastal areas to offshore oil development, you need to be just well aware that this is the scenario you're inviting to your coast. They talk a lot about how safe the technology is and how clean the technology is and the advancements that have been made. But we have seen two now major oil drilling accidents in the past year that have fouled wide stretches of important marine areas, the Timor Sea, Australia problem, and then this one here in the Gulf of Mexico. So this just gives proof to that lie. You know, oil and gas, it's dirty, it's dangerous, and it will affect our marine ecosystem.
You're planning another flyover the area in the next day or two. What will you be looking for?
Well, we'd like to see how they're progressing with this controlled burn. We want to see how that's, you know, actually being undertaken. And what we have found is it's just important to have independent eyes on the spill, because the information that we're getting from BP and from the Joint Command isn't necessarily matching up with reality. So I think we want to be out there independently assessing what's going on. You know, of course, it takes time, it takes energy, it takes resources, but as much as we can do, we're going to be monitoring that. We're going to be sharing that information on our website at healthygulf.org and giving people the most unfiltered and updated information we can.
Aaron Viles is campaign director with the Gulf Restoration Network in New Orleans. He joined us to talk about efforts to respond to the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Thank you for speaking with us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
More than 6,000 uninsured and underinsured people in Los Angeles are expected to receive free medical care, at least temporarily, at a large mobile clinic run by the nonprofit RAM, or Remote Area Medical. The clinic will operate at the site in LA for 7 days. With California's $20 billion deficit and deep cuts to health care in the state, the need for medical care has grown urgent for many. Dolores M. Bernal reports from Los Angeles.
300 dentist chairs have been placed in the middle of the Los Angeles sports arena to accommodate the hundreds of people coming in to receive free dental work at the biggest free clinic in America. The clinic is run by Remote Area Medical, or RAM, a nonprofit that travels across the country getting volunteer doctors and nurses to provide medical, dental, and vision care to people in urban and rural areas. Victor Romero is an undocumented Mexican worker and one of the many people seeking dental work.
I have two teeth with holes from cavities that need fillings, because when I eat it really hurts. The cost of dental work is so expensive, and here it's going to be free.
Last year, RAM came to Los Angeles for the first time, providing medical services to more than 6,000 people at the Hollywood Forum. Most of the patients are the working poor, the unemployed, and underinsured. Many of them have not seen a doctor in 10 or 20 years. Stan Brock is RAM's founder.
Another meaning of the word remote, of course, is not accessible. And so for these people, access to medical care for them was remote.
Even though they're in the middle of a big city.
Right. But we're just bringing a little bit of help for them.
Long Beach resident Roberta Taylor also came to this week's clinic seeking dental work.
So that is why I'm here, because my front tooth, where they just fixed it, oh, hallelujah.
If you had paid for it yourself, how much would it cost you?
Probably an arm and a leg, because I just had a tooth extraction done in Martin Luther King. They sent me a bill for $945. One, two. No, they crazy.
In 2009, the budget deficit in the state of California forced Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger to cut dental and vision coverage provided by Medi-Cal, the healthcare plan for the poor. California's First Lady Maria Shriver paid a visit to the free clinic's opening day. She took a tour of the facilities and greeted many of the patients who had been waiting since 5 in the morning to get medical care.
Mrs. Shriver, I've seen so much need here in Los Angeles. What does that say about the California healthcare system?
Well, I think it's, as Stan can attest, he sees this kind of need all over the country. It's not particular to California. We get a lot of attention because we're such a large state, but as he'll tell you, it's all over the United States of America.
At a press conference later in the day, Maria Shriver said that she was sorry that the need for healthcare in her state has been so great. When asked if her husband, Arnold Schwarzenegger, will be stopping by, she said no. Dolores M. Bernal, FSRN, Los Angeles.
The call to boycott Arizona is growing after the governor signed into law a controversial immigration bill. In Los Angeles, 7 city council members signed a proposal calling for the city to stop doing business in the state. San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom prohibited city employees from most official travel to Arizona, and City Supervisor David Campos introduced a non-binding resolution that calls on residents to avoid the state. At the state level, California Senate Leader Daryl Steinberg called on Governor Schwarzenegger to tear up the state's contracts with Arizona's public and private entities.
One of the great lessons for in and about the civil rights movement is that economic might matters. Desegregation ended when the business owners in Montgomery, Alabama, and other cities of the South recognized that they were going to lose patronage if the laws of segregation did not change.
Across the coast in Washington, D.C., the city council also plans to take up a boycott proposal. Meanwhile, dozens of truck drivers pledged to stop driving to Arizona, and boycott proponents are calling on sports fans and tourists to stay out of the state, where many visitors flock each summer to see the Grand Canyon. The anti-immigrant bill requires police to question and check the paperwork of anyone they think might be undocumented, including possibly victims and witnesses to a crime. Opponents say this is racial profiling and discrimination and question the constitutionality of the law. The Obama administration is also speaking out about the new law. Attorney General Eric Holder said the Justice Department is exploring legal challenges. President Obama spoke about it Tuesday night at a town hall meeting in Iowa.
This law that just passed in Arizona, which I think is a poorly conceived law, you can try to make it really tough on people who look like they, quote-unquote, might be illegal immigrants. One of the things that the law says is local officials are allowed to ask somebody who they have a suspicion might be a legal immigrant for their papers, but you can imagine if you are a Hispanic American in Arizona, your great-grandparents may have been there before Arizona was even a state.
The new law also makes it a state crime to be undocumented, and it prohibits people from hiring day laborers off the street. Supporters, including Republican Governor Jan Brewer, say it's necessary to fight crime from drug cartels. Despite the controversy, other states could follow. A state representative in Texas, Debbie Riddle, said she'll introduce similar legislation.
I'm Nell Abram in Tampa, Florida. There are just 3 days left in our Deep Roots campaign. More information is at fsrn.org. FSRN has been serving up independent news from communities around the world for 10 years. We're proud of our deep roots in the communities we live in and our deep roots in the media landscape. Help us nourish these deep roots. Visit us at fsrn.org to find out how.
On Capitol Hill today, top legal experts questioned the Obama administration's rationale for using unmanned drones to carry out killings of alleged terrorists. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
Drone use has increased under the Obama administration and has already outpaced President Bush. In fact, according to the New America Foundation, there were 34 drone attacks in Pakistan in 2008 and 53 in 2009. So far this year, there have been more than 18 attacks. Last March, State Department legal advisor Harold Koh told the American Society of International Law that Congress authorized the use of appropriate force after September 11 to go after al-Qaeda, and that still stands.
Al-Qaeda has not abandoned its intent to attack the United States. Indeed, it continues to attack us. And thus, in this ongoing armed conflict, the U.S. has the authority under international law and the responsibility to its citizens to use force, including lethal force, to defend itself.
But experts who testified at Wednesday's hearing said while the use of drones on a battlefield is permitted, outside of that arena is a breach of law. Mary Ellen O'Connell is a law professor at Notre Dame.
We have certain very strict rules in terms of how we may operate combat drones. First and foremost, only a combatant, a lawful combatant, may carry out the use of killing with combat drones. The CIA and civilian contractors have no right to do so. They do not wear uniforms, and they are not in the chain of command. And most importantly, they are not trained in the law of armed conflict.
Because the CIA runs a drone program, legal experts say it brings to question other aspects of U.S. policy. David Glazer is professor of law at Loyola Law School.
If we're using the CIA to conduct essentially armed attacks around the world, we must legally be taking a position that one does not have to be a classic uniformed military person to do that. Yet at Guantanamo, we are prosecuting members of al-Qaeda and the Taliban essentially under a legal theory that they have no right to participate in attacks against U.S. military forces because they are not uniformed military personnel themselves.
Some advocates have already questioned the Obama administration's use of drones. The ACLU sent a Freedom of Information Act request to the administration to find out details about the unmanned weapons program. The ACLU says it did not receive a reply back and has since taken the matter to court. Chris Anderson is senior legislative counsel with the ACLU. He says the program is outside of the law.
What the administration seems to be doing, although they weren't here to explain themselves, but what they seem to be doing is having this idea that there's an armed conflict that somehow is going on all over the world, and the same kinds of tools and tactics that they could use in Afghanistan and Iraq, they could use in places like Yemen, they could use them in Bosnia, they could use them in the Horn of Africa, and there's no reason why they wouldn't then chase and hunt down these people in other places around the world.
The ACLU sent President Obama a letter Wednesday outlining their concerns with the program. Other opponents say the use of unmanned aerial weapons, like drones, makes the U.S. more vulnerable. Paul Kawika-Martin is a political director with the group Peace Action.
Well, I think the bigger picture is, you know, we want to feel safer here in America, and how do we do that? Now, if you're attacking through a drone, through a joystick in Langley Park, CIA, some people feel safer because we're not putting our own folks at risks. But if you look at what happens on the ground when you kill innocent civilians, in the past, if you kill an innocent civilian and someone wants to try to go out for revenge, there's someone on the ground there, like a combat soldier, who they go after. If there's no one there, who do they go after?
In 2009, drones accounted for at least 500 deaths. Military officials say of that number, 118 were civilians, the rest militants. The next hearing on drones will feature officials from the state and defense departments. Karen Miller, FSRN, Washington.
In Washington, for the third time in as many days, Republicans blocked the financial reform bill from being debated in the Senate. Democrats charge that Republicans are stalling as a tactic to kill reform. Republicans say that Democrats are prematurely trying to debate a bill that's not yet ready. Meanwhile, lobbyists are fanned out across Capitol Hill to influence the legislation. At the heart of the lobbyists' interest is the part of the bill that would protect consumers. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
100 auto dealers traveled to Washington to lobby against one part of financial reform.
the Consumer Federal Protection Bureau, or CFPB. The Bureau would be set up under the Federal Reserve to protect consumers from abusive lending practices such as subprime mortgage and credit cards. But some businesses say they are being unfairly targeted, including auto dealers. They say they didn't cause the financial crisis.
It's such an overreach, and there's a lot of people that need to be excluded from it. And auto dealers are just another example.
Edward C. Tonkin owns 15 dealerships in Portland, Oregon. He's also this year's chair of the National Auto Dealers Association. He says this bill will impact every single auto dealer in the country because auto dealers play a role in financing a customer.
The dealership, however, provides a necessary service to go out and find a loan, find the proper agency who will make that loan to the customer.
But the top Democrat in charge of financial reform negotiations, Senator Chris Dodd, says the net doesn't reach that far. According to Senator Dodd, the auto dealer that directly issues a loan would be regulated. Those that send their customers to a bank won't.
If they're a finance company, if their principal business is in financial services and products, you are covered by this bill. If you're just a business that has a loan process out there, that's not your business, you're not covered by the Consumer Protection, Financial Protection Division.
What the bill says is that businesses that do a significant amount of financial service transactions would be subject to the new regulations. The word significant is not defined. The House of Representatives passed their version of financial reform last year. They created an exclusion for car dealers. That's what the dealers are seeking in the Senate bill. But they're up against some tough competition. The Department of Defense wrote a letter to the Senate asking that the car dealers not be exempt. They say members of the military are becoming prey to predatory lending. And 500 community bankers are on the Hill trying to ensure that car dealers and other businesses receive the same scrutiny that they do. Steve Rodier is with the Independent Community Bankers of America.
You know, from our standpoint, it's a competitive issue. But from the consumer standpoint, it's a protection issue. The consumer shouldn't have to figure out or think that they're going to get less protection if they go to a different kind of an institution. Everybody ought to be not only under the same rules, but actually playing by the same rules.
The car dealers aren't the only ones lobbying to be exempt. So are payday lenders and check cashing companies. Republicans, who have long been opposed to the new regulatory body for consumers, says this bill will impact most businesses that set up a payment plan. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell has said he's opposed to financial reform. This time, he says businesses will be unfairly impacted.
Does this mean that some graduate student in Louisville looking to buy an engagement ring would now be required to pay a higher interest rate? Or that the jeweler wouldn't do the deal because this bill would create new oversight over any non-financial institutions that lend money to consumers? What about the parent trying to spread out payments for their child's braces? Will they now have to pay for it all up front?
But Senator Dodd says these statements are inaccurate.
If you really believe that this bill does expose non-financial servicers and providers of financial products, then what's the language we need to fix that? Because none of us want to do that.
The Consumer Federal Protection Bureau is one part of the bill that's still being negotiated. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
And in a follow-up to our story this week on election results in Sudan, we also talked to Human Rights Watch about allegations of voter intimidation and censorship that people faced in the first multi-party voting in 24 years. You can listen to this interview at fsrn.org. And that wraps up today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. This is the last week of our Deep Roots campaign for April. Help us celebrate our 10-year anniversary at fsrn.org. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina. Thanks for listening.